And as we're right at the top of the hour, I'd like to introduce our speaker and his mentor today, Brad Cannell. PhD, MPH, is a veteran. I think I mangled that. I think it's Cannell. Veteran and associate professor at the University of Texas School of Public Health. And Julie Whiteloff, his mentor, PhD, is the director of the Women's Mental Health and Aging Corps at Division 21 MIRAC, and also a clinical professor at Stanford University School of Medicine. Julie, can I turn things over to you?
Yes, thank you. Well, welcome everyone. I'm really pleased that this seminar is happening. I'm also very pleased to be sharing the stage with Dr. Cannell, who is one of the one of my long-term collaborators, and our collaborative relationship started out with me mentoring him on his dissertation, and early on through his early career development period, we share a mutual interest in research on violence against women and elder maltreatment, and particularly pushing those fields forward to kind of think about how we move out of the descriptive space of just characterizing maltreatment of others as something that's harmful to health, and thinking about how we advance the science and think about what we do about it. So we're going to be sharing the results of several studies today that look at novel approaches to detecting elder abuse, and we'd like to tell you a little bit about both what we're doing with these projects, but also how we do it. We're a little bit of an unusual pairing, mentor and mentee pairing, in that Brad is in biostatistics, epidemiology, and data sciences, and I'm a clinical psychologist. So we want to talk a little bit about what we've learned about these kinds of interdisciplinary mentorship relationships as well. So with that, you're in for a treat today. Let's welcome Dr. Brad Cannell.
Thank you, and thank you, Julie and Rob, both of you. Before we get into the meat of the talk, have to do sort of the requisite disclosure kinds of things. So the portion of this research that I'm going to talk about today was actually supported by an award from the Department of Justice, National Institute of Justice. And I have to say that the opinions, findings, conclusions, and recommendations that we express do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Justice. And other than that, we have no financial disclosures. I also need to say that likewise, our opinions, conclusions, etc., do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Veterans Affairs. With that, here's sort of a quick roadmap of what we'd like to cover today. We're going to start with a brief overview of elder abuse and neglect. We're going to talk more specifically about detection and reporting of elder abuse and neglect. Then we're going to move into talking about our project, the DETECT project. And then Dr. Whiteloff is going to kind of take over and talk more about the relevancy to this project, specifically to the VA, and specifically, even more specifically, to the CDA program. So to get us started, Rob is going to go through a couple of poll questions that are going to help Dr. Whiteloff and I understand better, a little better, who you are.
And the poll is up. For the question, I primarily identify my professional role as, choices are a VA clinician, a VA clinician researcher, a VA non-clinician researcher, administrator, and other. And Brad and Julie, the answers are streaming in. They're about 60%, and we usually top off at around 80%. So we'll give people a few more moments to provide their answers. And things have leveled off, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results out to the audience. And I'll tell you, Brad, that for choice number one, a VA clinician, 14% chose that. 0%, nobody chose a VA clinician researcher. 21% chose a VA non-clinician researcher. 29% chose administrator, and 36% chose other. And I forgot to mention, audience members, you could use the questions pane if you'd like to give us details on what other means. And I could probably provide that to Brad during the second poll. Brad, would you like me to just jump right into the second poll question?
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay. For the second poll question, the question is, Which of the following best describes your familiarity with the topic of elder abuse and neglect? Selection number one, I think I've heard something about elder abuse once or twice. Number two, I'm no expert, but this topic is near and dear to my heart. Or I should be giving this webinar. And the answers are streaming in quicker this time. We don't have any more detail on what other meant to that 30-something percent. But we have leveled off, so I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it out. And I'll tell you that 33% chose option number one, which is I think I've heard something about elder abuse once or twice. 61% chose I'm no expert, but this topic is near and dear to my heart. And only 6% chose I should be giving this webinar. Now we're back to your slides.
Okay, great. Thanks, Rob. So I'm going to be honest. I'm not entirely sure what to make of the results from the first poll question, but I will do my best. On the second, I'm actually really encouraged to find out that this is something that many of you have some prior exposure to. And some of you, and those of you that actually could be giving this webinar, please contact me afterwards and let's talk, because I'm constantly learning and I would love to learn sort of what you think and maybe what you know that I don't know. So I will breeze through this slide. So this is just a definition of elder abuse, not necessarily the best one, certainly not the only one, but it gives us a starting point or a foundation. And that is an intentional act or failure to act by a caregiver or another person in a relationship involving an expectation of trust that causes harm or creates risk of harm to an older adult. So if there were any of you out there that had never heard of elder abuse before, hopefully this gives you some sort of baseline. Our best estimate is that at least 1 in 10 older adults, cognitively intact older adults, will experience elder abuse or neglect in a given year. Older adults here being defined as 60 and older. This stat comes from Rana Chirno's group at the Medical University of South Carolina, and it is based on a national random digit dial survey. And so the good thing about that is it's sort of nationally representative. The weakness of that, like all random digit dial surveys, is A, it relies on self-reporting, which we know can be problematic with this topic. It also is only asked of people who are cognitively and physically able to answer the phone and complete the survey. And those people may actually be at decreased risk of experiencing elder abuse compared to those who are unable physically and cognitively to answer the phone and complete the survey. And finally, there's other good evidence to support that the notion that elder abuse and neglect are underreported just generally. So that's why we say at least 1 in 10, the number is likely higher. Piggybacking on that, among those who are living with some form of dementia, the numbers are actually probably closer to 30 to 50%. These come from much smaller, less representative studies. So the variance is obviously going to be a lot broader or a lot greater, but certainly dementia is an important risk factor, and those living with dementia are actually at increased risk for elder abuse and neglect. Of course, I keep saying elder abuse and neglect as though it's a ubiquitous thing, which it is not. It's a pretty broad umbrella and under that umbrella, there are several different kinds of experiences, or what you'll sometimes hear as types of emotion or abuse and neglect. So the first two most common types are financial abuse and followed by neglect, and then emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. I should also point out here that very often where there is one form of abuse being experienced, there are also other forms of abuse that are co-occurring. Some risk factors here for elder abuse and neglect, just to sort of orient you to the slide, where you see in parentheses OA and or CG, the OA is older adult, the older adult victim, and CG is the caregiver, which could also be an older adult. So low social support, dementia, as I already mentioned, prior abuse exposure, dependence, mental health problems, substance use or misuse, and financial problems. And you may occasionally come across other risk factors in the literature, but in the literature that I've read, I think these are the ones that I most commonly see associated with elder abuse, and the ones that I'm most comfortable with saying, yeah, these are probably big risk factors that we should be thinking about. I think all of us would agree that elder abuse just in and of itself is a problem worth addressing and is a bad thing. But we'll go ahead and also talk about some of the impact that people experience as a result of elder abuse. And so number one is mortality. We know there's an association between elder abuse and neglect and mortality, physical injuries, functional decline. So there's a little asterisk there because actually a couple years ago now, Dr. Whiteloff and I published a study finding, in which we found an association between, actually a longitudinal association between experiencing emotional or physical abuse and future decline in physical function. And interestingly, it's not the topic of this presentation, but interestingly, we found that even emotional abuse in the absence of physical abuse, which may not immediately occur to most people, was strongly associated with declines in physical function later in life. So that was interesting. Depression and psychological distress, increased visits to ED, increased hospital admissions, and costs in the billions each year. That's a little vague. It's intentionally so. I'm aware of, I think, two or three studies that try to estimate the costs of elder abuse, and I think they the range, if I remember correctly, is about $5 billion a year to something in the $30 billion, $35 billion range per year. So again, not something we have a really firm grasp of, but clearly is an expensive problem in terms of social and financial costs each year. Additionally, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier when we were talking about prevalence, is that underreporting is a really big problem in the field of elder abuse, as it is to some extent in many kinds of interpersonal violence or research into interpersonal violence. Just to put a couple numbers to that, again, the Achernos group found that 1 in 14 cases of elder abuse are reported to the authorities. I should say only 1 in 14 cases are reported to the authorities. And then Weill Cornell Medical College, in collaboration with Lifespan of Greater Rochester, did a smaller study in New York and found that 3.2 per 1,000 older adults contacted social services or law enforcement for investigation and support. So hopefully at this point, I've convinced you that elder abuse is prevalent and that elder abuse is a problem worth addressing. So let's just address it, right? Well, one way to go about this would be to sort of identify and enumerate our population at risk. But this turns out to be a really difficult problem and a big problem in and of itself, right? Just getting a handle on who is and who is not experiencing elder abuse and neglect. And don't just take my word for it. A panel was gathered by the National Research Council and the Institute of Medicine back in 2003 to definitively describe the state of elder abuse research in the United States. That panel ended up creating the book that you see depicted here on the left part of the slide, which is still considered a very influential resource in the elder abuse community to this day. And a couple of the needs that they point out, it's actually a fairly thick book, but a couple of the things they point out which are relevant to today's talk are a need for new methods of sampling and identifying elder mistreatment victims in the community, and substantial research to improve and develop new methods of screening for possible elder mistreatment in a range of clinical settings. And as you'll see later on, Dr. Whiteloff and I interpret that last part, a range of clinical settings, fairly broadly to include the patient's home or residence when emergency medical services, more specifically EMTs and paramedics, are on scene. And at this point, it might be helpful for Dr. Whiteloff to actually discuss a little bit some of the difficulties that she's seen in sort of her clinical experience around detection of this topic.
Thanks very much for that. Yeah, so one of the things that I would like to point out here is that this is a population that can't always report what's happening to them. This is a population that can have a higher prevalence of psychiatric comorbidity or age-related decline that leads to problems with the veracity of reporting, right? So we know that confabulation and confusion and paranoia can be a part of dementia, and that can really confound not only reporting of elder abuse, but can contribute to elders not being believed when they do report it, and actually puts the position of the frontline medical responder in a really tricky position of trying to understand, you know, how do they detect what's real? How do they not over-respond to what isn't real? And how do they do this in a way that's sort of fair and efficient to the elder, but doesn't waste resources or investigate things that actually haven't happened? And so one of the issues with the new methods of sampling is looking at ways to get beyond self-report of the elder, right, or self-report of the caregiver, and thinking about how do we use technologies like direct observation to sort of, facilitate more efficient screening and also more accurate screening. And by the same token, did you want me to go into talking about the range of clinical settings, or did you want to move on, Brad?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead and talk about the range of clinical settings, please.
Well, and so for this reason, you know, sort of need to think about the fact that while we think about screening as something that is initiated in a medical setting, lots of these elders aren't regularly coming in or would be seen more often by someone who was not a frontline practitioner in a traditional clinical setting. A lot of these elders are homebound, and so thinking about how screening can be more widely implemented either in the home and or in community settings becomes really important for increasing the overall catch of detection of this problem. So Brad's going to talk a little bit about, you know, how this might roll out and how it did roll out in his project.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Whiteloff. As we've touched on, and Dr. Whiteloff, I think, really just highlighted nicely, social isolation, dementia, and, of course, declining health and poor functional status are all associated with elder abuse and neglect. Right? These are the people most likely to experience elder abuse and neglect. Additionally, we know that older adults are 4 times more likely to use emergency medical services than younger adults, okay? So, taken together, these risk factors and EMS utilization patterns, we really feel strongly suggest that EMTs may be uniquely positioned to identify potential cases of elder abuse and neglect that would otherwise go undetected. At the very least, we think it makes a lot of sense for emergency medical services, particularly EMTs and paramedics, to be a part of this, the solution to the detection problem. And so that's really what we've been focusing on the last couple years, and that's all well and good, but how do you operationalize this? Well, we started by conducting some focus groups with EMTs and paramedics, in particular with MedStar Mobile Healthcare, which provides all the ambulance service for Tarrant County, Texas, which is where I live. The city that you may or may not know from Tarrant County, Texas is Fort Worth, and it's one of the 4 counties that make up the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. So it's a relatively large county. It's a relatively large ambulance service. And to their credit, they actually approached me early on with some concerns about reporting and detection, and have been a vital partner in sort of developing some novel ways to help them detect elder abuse and neglect in the community, which we love. So as a result of those focus groups, we published a couple papers. The first one you see here on the screen is about the barriers to detecting elder abuse among emergency medical technicians. And as you can imagine, this was about the barriers that they experience and why they don't always currently detect or report elder abuse. And I'm sure that very few of you, if any of you, have actually read this article. But given that, we want to go ahead and move into a poll question where you take your best guess at which one of the following, I guess just to get your juices flowing here, which of the following is one of the barriers to reporting elder abuse and neglect among medics? And I'll turn it over to you, Rob.
Great, thank you. The poll is up, and answers are streaming in. So in answer to the question that Brad just read, option number one is, they don't perceive elder abuse and neglect to be high prevalence. Medics feel like it takes too long to make a report to APS. Medics feel pressure from their supervisors to avoid reporting. Medics are worried about becoming entangled in a lengthy legal proceeding. We have about 50% of the audience voted, so we'll leave it open for a few more moments to give people a chance to finish, make their decisions. And things have leveled off a little bit over 70%, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results.
That's really interesting. Okay. And so I should start by saying that some medic somewhere might agree with any of those four. The one we found on aggregate during our qualitative research was B. So medics feel like it takes too long to make a report to APS. D was a really popular distractor. I apologize for the typo there and about, but that is an interesting result. Maybe it's one we should talk about later.
It wasn't really a typo, Brad. I had to shorten it because of character limitations.
Oh, great. So now my ego is less bruised. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. Let's see. So the barriers that we found after conducting these focus groups were, one, medic apprehension towards violating the older adult's personal freedom to determine what conditions, the conditions of their living environment. So this is kind of like the, well, yeah, Mrs. Jones or Mr. Jones, you know, their house was filthy, or they were, you know, didn't necessarily have great hygiene or long fingernails or whatever the case may be. But, you know, who am I to sort of say that that's bad or pass judgment on them or that sort of thing, right? If that's how they want to live, they should be allowed to live that way. Number two was this moral anxiety about perceived negative consequences of an APS investigation. And so this sense that, you know, seeing APS as maybe like a law enforcement organization, which, by the way, it is not, at least not in the state of Texas. I'm not aware of it being a law enforcement agency anywhere in the country. It certainly isn't in Texas. But this sense that, you know, well, if I call APS, I'm going to get someone in trouble, and I don't really want to be saddled with that guilt, particularly if it isn't actually elder abuse or neglect that's occurring. Three is the time burden, which was the answer to the previous poll question. And this sort of manifests in two ways. So one is, you can imagine if you are the medic and you're at Mrs. Jones' house and she's currently experiencing cardiac arrest, that is obviously the issue that takes precedence over screening for elder abuse and neglect at the moment. And then there is also a time crunch to get her treatment and get her to the hospital, right? So that's one aspect of the time burden. The other aspect is, you know, you think about, well, maybe in between calls or in between emergency responses, you make the report to APS. Well, it turns out, you know, one, sometimes the very next call is right away, right? And then that, again, takes precedence. Or two, and I want to caveat here that we did this study a few years back, and I think there may have been some improvements since then. But at the time we did this, paramedics were consistently telling us that it took an hour or more, in some cases, to make a report to APS, which was just time they didn't feel like they had to devote to that process. Four is a perceived lack of recallability. So if they did try or attempt to or think about making that report later on after they've cleared the scene, they weren't sure that, you know, they weren't recording their observations anywhere, and they weren't sure that, you know, they didn't feel very confident in their ability to recall the pertinent details needed to make a report. And then five is low medic confidence regarding their ability to correctly identify potential elder abuse and neglect. And so, what they told us a lot were things like, yeah, I kind of had this gut feeling, or maybe something just seemed a little off, but, you know, I'm no expert on this and I really can't put my finger on it. And then on top of that is the moral anxiety thing, you know, so I just don't feel really confident in my own ability to make a subjective judgment about whether this situation is abuse or neglect. Okay. But they did say, hey, I can sometimes tell when things are not quite right or things feel a little off. And we dug a little bit and we said, okay, so tell us more about that. And what we got from that process was this list of 8 indicators of abuse, right? Or things that they experience when they're out on an emergency response call that may be indicative or may be predictive of elder abuse and neglect occurring. And so that is the conditions outside the home, the conditions inside the home, lack of or inadequacy of social support, the patient's medical history and or medication use or misuse patterns, caregiving indicators or the relationship between the older adult and the caregiver, the physical condition of the older adult's behavior, and again, this thing that we just ended up calling instinct or this gut feeling, right? And so we said, okay, how do we, and I think those of you who are in very clinical settings may appreciate this, is that there's a lot of stuff on this list that may be associated with and predictive of elder abuse that you all never get the opportunity to observe in a medical clinical setting, right, in a hospital or a clinic, that these medics are having an opportunity and do observe out in the community, right? And so how do we really capitalize on that really probably really useful information and at the same time help the medics get over some of those barriers that we talked about to detecting and reporting? And so what they talked to us some about and what we agreed was a good idea was to create some sort of screening tool that they could use. And so we published on this topic as well. And at the end of the day, we came up with a few, with the help of the medics, we came up with a few criteria for the screening tool that we wanted to develop. So one, it needed to be brief, right? There's already a lot of things they're doing at the scene of an emergency response. And as we already talked about, time is of the essence. So we really wanted to create something as brief as possible that's still useful. Two, it needed to be based on direct observation, okay? So going back to Mrs. Jones and cardiac arrest, it doesn't make a lot of sense if the first, you know, 5 items are you asking Mrs. Jones if she feels safe at home and when was the last time she did this thing or that thing, right? That just doesn't make a lot of sense many times in an emergency setting. In addition to that, a lot of the medics reported being pretty uncomfortable about asking questions related to some of these sensitive topics, okay? And then thirdly, you know, we just talked about the predictive value of all this extra information that you get by being in the older adult's home, which isn't, you know, questions don't make sense in that context, right? So we were very deliberate from the beginning about systematic direct observation of the older adult, the caregiver, and the physical and social environment. Third here is the decision rule. So this kind of goes back to that moral anxiety piece, which is we really want the detect tool to take in all the pertinent information and tell the medic, yeah, this is a situation where you really should make a report to Adult Protective Services, and here's how you do that. And thereby relieving some of that guilt or moral anxiety, because if it turns out that they make a report to Adult Protective Services and this is not a case of elder abuse or neglect, it's the detect tool's fault. It's not my fault, the medic's fault, right? And then 4, easily incorporated into their current standard operating procedure. Okay, so this kind of goes back to, you know, and again, some of you may be able to appreciate this, like, look, I need another paper screening tool, like I need a hole in the head, right? Like, make this easy and make it make sense in the flow, in my current workflow. And so we've worked hard at that too, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. So what we came up with is called, as Rob mentioned earlier, is called Detection of Elder Abuse Through Emergency Care Technicians, or DETECT. What you see here is a screenshot. This is actually an older version, but it's close enough to the new version to sort of give you an idea. This is built into MedStar's Electronic Patient Care Reporting System, or EPCR. It's sort of similar to an EHR at a hospital, maybe. And it is a little bit smart in the sense that it only pops up when the call, when responding to a call for a person who is 65 years of age or older at a private residence and in the community. So it would not pop up like at the scene of a car crash, even if one of the victims was 65 years old. And it would not pop up, for instance, at like a skilled nursing facility, even if the patient was 65 years old. The reason for the car crash hopefully is obvious. You know, there's none of the environmental cues there that we're looking for in the home, typically anyway. And then the reason for the skilled nursing facility is because in the state of Texas and in most states, that is not investigated by APS. And so the sort of the thing we prompt them to do at the end is call APS, which wouldn't make sense in that environment. And really in elder abuse research, abuse that occurs in an institutional setting is typically viewed and researched separately from abuse that occurs in a residential community setting. The other thing I want to point out here real quickly is that I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but there are 800,000 medics operating in every county in the United States currently. And that image trend, which is the EPCR that MedStar uses, where we built this module, is used by some medics in every state in the United States, and it's the official statewide system of 36 states. And the reason that's important and one of the things that we are particularly excited about is when and if we get to a point where we feel like the Detect tool really is a valuable asset to older adults and to the first responder community, we think there's a really good opportunity to push this out nationwide with fairly few barriers, at least technical barriers, and you know, instantly, maybe literally overnight, have an entire new force of sentinel surveillance for elder abuse and neglect. So we want to be really careful about doing that, and we want to really make sure that we dot our I's and cross our T's before it gets to that. But again, that potential is really exciting to us. Okay, so we've done two pilot tests of the Detect tool so far. One was an initial 5-week pilot test done at the very end of 2015. The other was a year-long pilot test that we just wrapped up not that long ago. And we don't have the results back from it yet. I wish we did, and I wish I could talk to you about those today, but I can't. What I will talk to you about is the 5-week pilot test. So here we go. During that 5-week period, the screening tool was used by 251 medics, and it rolled out to almost 1,500 calls, emergency calls for qualified older adults. And remember the qualification criteria I gave you earlier. At those calls, 1,248 Detect screenings were conducted. Of those, 209 were positive. So for this, you know, preliminary pilot study, we chose a really conservative bar for positive, which was answered yes to any one of the Detect screening items. Okay, we do have plans in the future to try to do something a little bit more sophisticated, which I can talk about later. But that was in this context, that's what positive means. So this gets, I think, a little bit to feasibility, and it gets a little bit to detection, although in a very imperfect way. This next slide, now we start to move into talking about reporting. And I want to orient you to this graph a little bit. So along the x-axis here, you have time in months, calendar months, and this is for the year 2015, which is when we conducted the 5-week pilot study, January through December. On the y-axis, you have number of reports to APS. The blue rug plot at the bottom are individual reports, and the two red vertical dashed lines are the start and the end of our 5-week pilot study, respectively. And so you look at this black line, which is the aggregate reports by month, right? And I guess there's two things to point out on this graph. So if you kind of train your eyes over the bottom left corner of January, and you kind of draw like a little regression line in your head between January and July, you see that there's probably kind of a little, well, there's not probably, there is a little upward trend in reporting through that time period anyway. The second part is you get over to the 5-week pilot study, and you see that in between those red lines, there's this, you know, fairly substantial jump in reporting during the time period where medics had access to the detect screening tool, okay? And then you look up at the top left, and so you find that even after accounting for that upward trend that you see in the beginning of the year, we have a modeled average of 3.6, of increase in 3.6 reports per month. The raw increase is actually much higher than that. So pretty encouraging results for a small 5-week pilot study, we felt. A little contingency table here, and I just want to use it to make two points. I'll orient it to you real quickly. So the top row where you see EA plus and EA minus is going to be our gold standard of elder abuse is actually occurring or not occurring, and that's based on APS investigation. And then the second row and third row headers are detect plus and detect minus. That is whether the detect screening was positive or negative. So the first thing I want to point out is the red false negative there with a question mark and the red true negative there with a question mark. Because there was no follow-up done after a negative detect screening, we don't know, our data can't tell us what these numbers are, and therefore we can't calculate basic measures of validity like sensitivity and specificity. And in the interest of time, I think that's the big thing, and I'm going to move on. So the strengths of what we've done so far, I think we have demonstrated that this is a feasible thing to implement even in a busy, bustling EMS service. We did see an increase in reporting. And then the thing I skipped was the low false discovery rate. So when a report was made, 90% of the time it ended up being validated by APS as a true case of elder abuse or neglect. And in the process, we've made a lot of strong community connections, which play into the next phase of the DETECT project, which I'll talk about in a moment. Opportunities. So reporting is all self-report data from MedStar. That's something that we're working on improving our measure of. There's no information or follow-up for negative screens, which we talked about and something that we're currently working on. There's no gold standard. So if you remember, we were using APS investigation as a gold standard. There's a lot of reasons to think that's not the best gold standard to use. And then there's really no contextual information. We know the screening responses and we know the APS investigation responses, and that's about it in the previous version of DETECT. So we've created a new version, and we were recently funded to carry out this new version. And I'm going to quickly run through what the aims of the second phase of DETECT are. So one, we want to really validate in a very rigorous way the DETECT screening tool, and we're going to do that by conducting screenings with DETECT as we did in the past, but also we're hiring our own workforce of medics to go out and do follow-up follow-up elder abuse and neglect screenings with a random subset of those who were screened with DETECT. The 5-week version was 26 items. The year-long version of DETECT was 14 items. We really would like to get that down closer to 5 items if we can do so while maintaining the validity and reliability of the tool. And finally, we're going to collect a lot of contextual information when we're doing these rigorous follow-up evaluations that we hope will uncover either novel risk and protective factors and or novel ways or subtleties about those risk and protective factors that are known that may allow us to sort of intervene in novel ways. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Whiteloff to kind of talk about the relevance of all this to the VA environment.
Thank you. So yes, we think a lot about this with the growing population of aging veterans. in the VA, and we know that there is a significant caregiver burden in the homes of those veterans, and we know that many of our aging veterans are medically and psychologically complex. And so thinking about their risk for elder abuse and also some of the challenges for timely detection of that, I think it's one of the ways that this project is relevant. I think we're also seeing, we know there's a dramatic increase in the population of aging women veterans, and we know that prior exposure to abuse through intimate partner violence, military sexual trauma, all of these different factors are a risk factor for maltreatment in their golden years. So thinking about ways in which to increase our prowess with early detection of elder maltreatment in this population, I think is a very pertinent priority for us. Finally, I think we're really well positioned actually to sort of think about methodologically how we go about detection of elder maltreatment, especially detection in the home with the many points of care that we have that go outside of the traditional clinical settings here. So we have many home-based primary care resources within VA, and this may be an excellent opportunity to start looking at the contextual factors in the veteran's home that may lead to their risk for maltreatment. And so just to sort of wrap up, I know that Brad took us through a sort of a whirlwind tour of this multi-year project that he's working on. And I just wanted to step back for a second and talk to the CDA community that's on the line about, you know, what we've learned, not only about this topic, but about, you know, how to really make interdisciplinary mentorship and research relationships productive. And I would say that while I started out as the mentor, certainly Brad is now more than a colleague, and more often than not, I'm learning from him. But I think one of the things that was really fascinating and also challenging about working on a topic of maltreatment with a methodologist and a clinician team is the different perspectives we have on how to go about this, how to capture this, what pieces of the story are the most relevant. And I think that it's taught us both a lot about learning to take the other person's perspective and having some tolerance for what was really a fairly iterative cycle of conceptualizing and reconceptualizing the problem. So, you know, it, just as an example, everyone has read the myriad of papers that says something like physical, sexual, and emotional abuse is bad for women, it's bad for children, it's bad for elders. Here's the laundry list of health problems that will flow from maltreatment. Here's the laundry list of mental health problems that will flow from treatment. And we should really screen for maltreatment. The issue is that the screening wasn't adequate for this population, and so thinking about how to move the science forward in screening better required really some tension between, you know, methodological approach and some clinical insight to how to approach this topic. And I think that Brad, you may want to jump in. I think that that requires a lot of discipline in terms of thinking about what each member brings to the research relationship and having a lot of clarity in defining and redefining the mentorship goals, and that, you know, with all the mentorship in the world, Brad wasn't going to become a clinical psychologist because we were working together, and with all my collaboration with him in the world, I'm not going to become an epidemiologist. And so thinking about how you share the research base and also keep the professional status is clear, I think was one of the most important things that we've learned and how to negotiate that over time. Do you want to jump in, Brad?
Yeah, I agree. I think the only thing I have to maybe add to this topic is, we all hear about the importance of interdisciplinary research, interdisciplinary mentorship. That has certainly been an important component of my career in general and the DETECT project specifically. I don't necessarily have any special insight to share with this group that you probably haven't already heard before. I guess the one sort of specific nugget I have that may or may not be useful is really about, it's no surprise to anybody that when you're coming to a problem with a different disciplinary lens, that you will see things differently. Where I have seen, and that can go, you know, in at least one of two ways. One is everybody around the table, or the two people around the table, whatever it is, spend that time together trying to convince the other person or the other discipline while why their way is superior to theirs, right? Why my way is superior to yours and you should be viewing it this way, right? Or you can take a little bit of a leap of faith and have some trust in your collaborators and make a very intentional effort to sort of check your ego and check your instincts via training and say, you know what, this is how I would approach it. But this person across the table from me or on the other end of the phone from me, whatever the case may be, is somebody that I respect, I trust, I think has a great deal of competence. And I'm going to take a little bit of a leap of faith here and go with their idea on this one. And that is often difficult for us as researchers to do, right? But I can tell you that in my experience on this project and others, it's something that I've had to make a very deliberate, thoughtful effort about doing, and it's something that's made all my work better.
Wonderful. And I know we're wrapping up here and about to open the floor to questions, but, you know, I just wanted to make one more mention, which is that, you know, I think all the things that Brad had mentioned, that we worked a lot at understanding where one another was coming from, where the skill differences were because we were in different professions, even the different lexicons that are used for talking about the same things, and took a lot of effort to kind of make sure that we were on the same page and staying on the same page. But the other thing that I'll mention to the CDA community is that Brad and I have worked together as mentor and mentee and as collaborator for 7 years now, and it had been entirely digital and long distance, and we met in person for the first time this month. So, you know, I want to put that out to the CDA community. I know that there's a lot of people who are frustrated because maybe they're in a setting where some of their mentors aren't local. It's absolutely possible in this day and age to have very productive mentorship across the miles. But again, it does require sort of the investment of time and effort of understanding where your collaborator or your mentor or your mentee is coming from. So with that, Rob, I suspect it's more than time for questions.
Thank you very much, Drs. Whitelaw and Kennell. At this time, we don't have any pending questions. Audience members, if you have a question, now would be the time to submit it, and you would do that by using the questions pane in the GoToWebinar dashboard, one of those white sections in the GoToWebinar dashboard. Just go ahead and type your question in. In the meantime, I actually had a question, if you don't mind me asking. Do you have, Brad, do you have any idea as to why the last poll confused so many people, that they answered, 60% answered that MedX would be worried about becoming entangled in lengthy legal proceedings as opposed to what the real answer was?
I think there's one of two potential explanations for that. One is that that is what the audience is experiencing in their own life for one reason or another, or at least how they personally would answer that question, right? The other potential explanation is that I'm just such a good question writer that I had three really great, and particularly one really great distractor there. Probably it's the first.
Thank you. We still don't have any pending questions, so this would be a good opportunity for anybody who wants to make any closing comments. Julie,
sure.
Maybe you want to do a wrap up?
Yeah, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present this topic. I think that new strategies for detecting maltreatment of elders and also of others is really important. And in the day and age of universal screening for everything, the question of whether or not we're capturing the data that we want to capture and making forward movement, I think, is sort of the most important question. And I think that the DETECT project shows a really novel and innovative way to not only address the problem, but look at rapid dissemination. So I think that this is really important, and I look forward to ways to bring this into the VA.
Yeah, and I wanted to just quickly give some acknowledgments here to MedStar Mobile Healthcare, the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, the Fort Worth Safe Communities Coalition, Dr. Jen Ringel-Gonzalez, my colleague here at the University of Texas, Dr. Doug Livingston, my colleague at Emory, and Dr. Sid O'Brien, my colleague at the University of North Texas Health Science Center, who have all played vital roles either in the early stages of ATT&CT or in the forthcoming stages of ATT&CT. So I want to thank them and make sure they get their credit as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both very much for your work and for preparing and presenting this afternoon. Audience members, when I close the meeting momentarily, you'll be prompted with a feedback form. Please take a few moments to fill that out. We really do appreciate and count on your feedback to continue to deliver high-quality cyber seminars. Once again, Dr. Cannell and Dr. Whitelove, thank you for your work and for presenting today. Good day, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.